Chapter 24. Considering the opportunities that these other fellows had, I don't see that Mr. Lowe said anything against me, and neither did Mr. Donna. However, I will say that I never heard so many lies told in one evening as were told by Mr. McElway, and I consider myself very capable. But even in his case, when he got through, I was gratified by finding how much he hadn't found out. By accident he missed the very things that I didn't want to have said. And now, gentlemen, about Americanism. I have been on the continent of Europe for 2.5 years. I have met many Americans there, some sojourning for a short time only, others making protracted stays, and it has been very gratifying to me to find that nearly all preserved their Americanism. I have found they all like to see the flag fly, and that their hearts rise when they see the stars and stripes. I met only one lady who had forgotten the land of her birth and glorified monarchical institutions. I think it is a great thing to say that in 2.5 years I met only one person who had fallen a victim to the shams, I think we may call them shams, of nobilities and of heredities. She was entirely lost in them. After I had listened to her for a long time, I said to her, "At least you must admit that we have one merit. We are not like the Chinese, who refuse to allow their citizens who are tired of the country to leave it. Thank God, we don't." Copyright with Mr. Howells, Edward Everett Hale, Thomas Nelson Page, and a number of other authors. Mr. Clemens appeared before the committee December 6, 1906. The new copyright bill contemplated an author's copyright for the term of his life and for 50 years thereafter, applying also for the benefit of artists, musicians, and others, but the authors did most of the talking. F. D. Millett made a speech for the artists, and John Philip Sousa for the musicians. Mr. Clemens was the last speaker of the day, and its chief feature. He made a speech, the serious parts of which created a strong impression, and the humorous parts set the senators and representatives in roars of laughter. I have read this bill. At least I have read such portions as I could understand. Nobody but a practiced legislator can read the bill and thoroughly understand it, and I am not a practiced legislator. I am interested particularly and especially in the part of the bill which concerns my trade. I like that extension of copyright life to the author's life and 50 years afterward. I think that would satisfy any reasonable author, because it would take care of his children. Let the grandchildren take care of themselves. That would take care of my daughters, and after that I am not particular. I shall then have long been out of this struggle, independent of it, indifferent to it. It isn't objectionable to me that all the trades and professions in the United States are protected by the bill. I like that. They are all important and worthy, and if we can take care of them under the copyright law, I should like to see it done. I should like to see oyster culture added, and anything else. I am aware that copyright must have a limit, because that is required by the Constitution of the United States, which sets aside the earlier Constitution, which we call the Decalogue. The Decalogue says you shall not take away from any man his profit. I don't like to be obliged to use the harsh term. What the Decalogue really says is, thou shalt not steal, but I am trying to use more polite language. The laws of England and America do take it away, do select but one class, the people who create the literature of the land. They always talk handsomely about the literature of the land, always what a fine, great monumental thing a great literature is, and in the midst of their enthusiasm they turn around and do what they can to discourage it. I know we must have a limit, but 42 years is too much of a limit. I am quite unable to guess why there should be a limit at all to the possession of the product of a man's labor. There is no limit to real estate. Dr. Bailey suggested that a man might just as well, after discovering a coal mine and working it 42 years, have the government step in and take it away. What is the excuse? It is that the author who produced that book has had the profit of it long enough, and therefore the government takes a profit which does not belong to it, and generously gives it to the 88,000,000 of people. But it doesn't do anything of the kind. It merely takes the author's property, takes his children's bread, and gives the publisher double profit. He goes on publishing the book, and as many of his confederates as choose to go into the conspiracy do so, and they rear families in affluence. And they continue the enjoyment of those ill-gotten gains generation after generation forever, for they never die. In a few weeks or months or years I shall be out of it, I hope under a monument. I hope I shall not be entirely forgotten, and I shall subscribe to the monument myself. But I shall not be caring what happens, if there are 50 years left of my copyright. My copyright produces annually a good deal more than I can use, but my children can use it. I can get along, I know a lot of trades. But that goes to my daughters, who can't get along as well as I can, because I have carefully raised them as young ladies, who don't know anything, and can't do anything. I hope Congress will extend to them the charity which they have failed to get from me. Why, if a man who is not even mad, but only strenuous about race suicide should come to me, and try to get me to use my large political and ecclesiastical influence, to get a bill passed by this Congress limiting families to 22 children by one mother, I should try to calm him down. I should reason with him. I should say to him, leave it alone. Leave it alone, and it will take care of itself. Only one couple a year in the United States can reach that limit. If they have reached that limit, let them go right on. Let them have all the liberty they want. In restricting that family to 22 children, you are merely conferring discomfort and unhappiness on one family per year in a nation of 88,000,000, which is not worthwhile. It is the very same with copyright. One author per year produces a book which can outlive the 42-year limit, that's all. This nation can't produce two authors a year that can do it. The thing is demonstrably impossible. All that the limited copyright can do is to take the bread out of the mouths of the children of that one author per year. I made an estimate some years ago, when I appeared before a committee of the House of Lords, that we had published in this country since the Declaration of Independence 220,000 books. They have all gone. They had all perished before they were 10 years old. It is only one book in 1,000 that can outlive the 42-year limit. Therefore, why put a limit at all? You might as well limit the family to 22 children. If you recall the Americans in the 19th century who wrote books that lived 42 years, you will have to begin with Cooper. You can follow with Washington Irving, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Edgar Allan Poe, and there you have to wait a long time. You come to Emerson, and you have to stand still and look further. You find Howells and T.B. Aldrich, and then your numbers begin to run pretty thin, and you question, if you can name 20 persons in the United States who in a whole century have written books that would live 42 years. Why, you could take them all, and put them on one bench there, pointing at the wives and children, and you could put the result on two or three more benches. 100 persons, that is a little, insignificant crowd whose bread dash and butter is to be taken away for what purpose, for what profit to anybody? You turn these few books into the hands of the pirate, and of the legitimate publisher too, and they get the profit that should have gone to the wife and children. When I appeared before that committee of the House of Lords, the chairman asked me what limit I would propose. I said, perpetuity. I could see some resentment in his manner, and he said the idea was illogical, for the reason that it has long ago been decided that there can be no such thing as property in ideas. I said there was property in ideas before Queen Anne's time. They had perpetual copyright. He said, what is a book? A book is just built from base to roof on ideas, and there can be no property in it. I said I wished he could mention any kind of property on this planet that had a pecuniary value which was not derived from an idea or ideas. He said real estate. I put a supposititious case, a dozen Englishmen who travel through South Africa and camp out, and 11 of them see nothing at all, they are mentally blind. But there is one in the party who knows what this harbor means, and what the lay of the land means. To him it means, that someday a railway will go through here, and there on that harbor a great city will spring up. That is his idea. And he has another idea, which is to go, and trade his last bottle of Scotch whiskey, and his last horse blanket to the principal chief of that region, and buy a piece of land the size of Pennsylvania. That was the value of an idea, that the day would come when the Cape to Cairo Railway would be built. Every improvement that is put upon the real estate is the result of an idea in somebody's head. The skyscraper is another idea, the railroad is another, the telephone and all those things are merely symbols which represent ideas. An andiron, a wash tub, is the result of an idea that did not exist before. So if, as that gentleman said, a book does consist solely of ideas, that is the best argument in the world, that it is property, and should not be under any limitation at all. We don't ask for that. 50 years from now we shall ask for it. I hope the bill will pass without any deleterious amendments. I do seem to be extraordinarily interested in a whole lot of arts and things that I have got nothing to do with. It is a part of my generous, liberal nature, I can't help it. I feel the same sort of charity to everybody that was manifested by a gentleman who arrived at home at 2 o'clock in the morning from the club, and was feeling so perfectly satisfied with life, so happy, and so comfortable, and there was his house weaving, weaving, weaving around. He watched his chance, and by when the steps got in his neighborhood he made a jump and climbed up, and got on the portico. And the house went on weaving and weaving and weaving, but he watched the door, and when it came around his way he plunged through it. He got to the stairs, and when he went up on all fours the house was so unsteady, that he could hardly make his way, but at last he got to the top, and raised his foot, and put it on the top step. But only the toe hitched on the step, and he rolled down and fetched up on the bottom step, with his arm around the newel post, and he said, God pity the poor sailors out at sea on a night like this. An aide of the blind, address at a public meeting of the New York Association for Promoting the Interests of the Blind at the Waldorf Astoria, March 29, 1906, if you detect any awkwardness in my movements and infelicities in my conduct I will offer the explanation, that I never presided at a meeting of any kind before in my life, and that I do find it out of my line. I supposed I could do anything anybody else could. But I recognize that experience helps, and I do feel the lack of that experience. I don't feel as graceful and easy as I ought to be in order to impress an audience. I shall not pretend that I know how to umpire a meeting like this, and I shall just take the humble place of the Essex band. There was a great gathering in a small New England town, about 20-5 years ago. I remember that circumstance, because there was something that happened at that time. It was a great occasion. They gathered in the militia and orators, and everybody from all the towns around. It was an extraordinary occasion. The little local paper threw itself into ecstasies of admiration, and tried to do itself proud from beginning to end. It praised the orators, the militia, and all the bands that came from everywhere, and all this in honest country newspaper detail, but the writer ran out of adjectives toward the end. Having exhausted his whole magazine of praise and glorification, he found he still had one band left over. He had to say something about it, and he said the Essex band done the best it could. I am an Essex band on this occasion, and I am going to get through as well as in experience, and good intentions will enable me. I have got all the documents here necessary to instruct you in the objects and intentions of this meeting, and also of the association which has called the meeting. But they are too voluminous. I could not pack those statistics into my head, and I had to give it up. I shall have to just reduce all that mass of statistics to a few salient facts. There are too many statistics and figures for me. I never could do anything with figures, never had any talent for mathematics, never accomplished anything in my efforts at that rugged study, and today the only mathematics I know is multiplication, and the minute I get away up in that, as soon as I reach 9 times 7,
Mr. Clemens lapsed into deep thought for a moment. He was trying to figure out 9 times 7, but it was a hopeless task, and he turned to St. Clair McKelway, who sat near him. Mr. McKelway whispered the answer, and the speaker resumed.
I've got it now. It's 84. Well, I can get that far all right with a little hesitation. After that I am uncertain, and I can't manage a statistic. This association for the
Mr. Clemens was in another dilemma. Again he was obliged to turn to Mr. McKelway.
Oh yes, for promoting the interests of the blind. It's a long name. If I could I would write it out for you, and let you take it home and study it, but I don't know how to spell it. And Mr. Carnegie is down in Virginia somewhere. Well, anyway, the object of that association which has been recently organized 5 months ago, in fact, is in the hands of very, very energetic, intelligent, and capable people, and they will push it to success very surely, and all the more surely, if you will give them a little of your assistance out of your pockets. The intention, the purpose, is to search out all the blind, and find work for them to do, so that they may earn their own bread. Now it is dismal enough, to be blind, it is dreary, dreary life at best, but it can be largely ameliorated, by finding something for these poor blind people, to do with their hands. The time passes so heavily, that it is never day or night with them, it is always night, and when they have to sit with folded hands, and with nothing to do to amuse or entertain or employ their minds, it is drearier and drearier. And then the knowledge they have, that they must subsist on charity, and so often reluctant charity, it would renew their lives, if they could have something to do with their hands and pass their time, and at the same time earn their bread, and know the sweetness of the bread which is the result of the labor of one's own hands. They need that cheer and pleasure. It is the only way you can turn their night into day. To give them happy hearts, the only thing you can put in the place of the blessed sun, that you can do in the way I speak of. Blind people generally who have seen the light know what it is to miss the light. Those who have gone blind, since they were 20 years old, their lives are unendingly dreary. But they can be taught to use their hands, and to employ themselves at a great many industries. That association from which this draws its birth in Cambridge, Massachusetts, has taught its blind to make many things. They make them better than Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.